So I begin with a quotation from Jerome Bruner, and I'm going to just read it without comment, not at this point. A look at children as they actually acquire language shows St. Augustine to be far, far off target. It is one of the mysteries of Kuhnian scientific paradigms that the empiricist approach to language acquisition has persisted in psychology, if not in philosophy, where it was overturned by Frege and Wittgenstein from its enunciation by St. Augustine. So he's writing this in 83. So part of what I'm responding to is that it certainly has not gone away in philosophy. And the Augustinian conception of language. So I start. The so-called method of cases, or in other words, theorizing on the basis of the application of terms to cases, has been a very common form of practice among analytic philosophers. But this philosophical notion of applying words is a piece of philosophical jargon. As such, it covers up fundamental and problematic assumptions about language that underwrite the method of cases. Applying terms to cases is what we're supposed to do in responding to questions such as, does the protagonist of this story know that such and such? Or is the protagonist of this story morally responsible for doing this or that? Or did the protagonist of this story do this or that intentionally? The general form of such questions is this a case of X? Where X is the term that the question invites us to apply to the described case, either positively or negatively. I call any question of this general form, when it is raised in the context of philosophical theorizing, the theorist's question. Much of the work in contemporary analytic philosophy proceeds, either directly or indirectly, on the basis of answers to different versions of the theorist question. In When Words Are Called For, I argue against the method of cases by way of ordinary language philosophy, focusing on the very examples that philosophers have used in their arguments for this or that theory of knowledge. I try to show that outside philosophy, no one who finds herself facing cases such as those described in those examples would ask the theorist's question. And this is because, to put it very roughly, questions that arise naturally in the everyday have a point. And what they come to, how they are to be appropriately understood and responded to, is inseparable from their point. Whereas, by design and fully self-consciously, the theorist's question has no point in the relevant sense. This raises serious questions about what, if anything, the answers that we find ourselves inclined to give to that question are supposed to reveal. But it is very important for me to emphasize in When Words Are Called For that the practice of ordinary language philosophy, as I understand and seek to defend it, presupposes no substantive theoretical assumptions about language. On something like the contrary, I argue in the book, that the practice of ordinary language philosophy is both possible and called for, sometimes called for, is part of what any plausible theory of language would need to explain. Today I want to present a small portion of more recent work in which I try to develop a more theoretical critique of the philosophical method of cases and the conception of language that underwrites it. As someone who has been much influenced by Wittgenstein, taking a more theoretical approach scares me. For, as Kripke says in Naming a Necessity, if it's a theory, it is surely false. My taking this approach is largely the result of my growing admiration for the expressly more theoretical work of Maurice Merleau-Ponty. I have found both the insightfulness of Merleau-Ponty's phenomenology and its differences from the kind of insightfulness afforded by Wittgenstein's grammatical investigations hard to deny. At the same time, I've also been struck by deep similarities between what these two great philosophers each say, in particular about language and about the nature of philosophical difficulty. And it has seemed to me, at the very least, unclear and worth exploring what, if anything, a Wittgensteinian should find objectionable about Merleau-Ponty's phenomenology. More immediately, I was prompted to my current philosophical project by a series of books and papers in which mainstream analytic philosophers such as Timothy Williamson, Frank Jetson, Alvin Goldman, Herman Capellan, Jennifer Nagel have tried to defend the philosophical method of cases against various lines of skepticism by arguing that the theorist's questions invite us to do something that as competent speakers we do and must do all the time outside philosophy, namely apply terms to cases, or classify or categorize cases with respect to this or that term or concept. Skepticism about answer to the theorist's questions, these philosophers have argued, therefore amounts to skepticism about judgment in general, and is no more worthy of a refutation on its own terms than such general skepticism presumably would be. I call this line of defense of the method of cases the claim of continuity. In making the claim of continuity, these philosophers have shown themselves committed to a substantive conception of language, a commitment that many of them have made more or less explicit. As it turns out, the conception of language that underwrites the method of cases is essentially the empiricist, so-called Augustinian conception of language that Wittgenstein identifies at the opening of the investigation as lying at the root of at least very many traditional philosophical difficulties. That this conception is taken for granted by all parties to the current lively debates concerning the philosophical method of cases shows the extent to which contemporary mainstream analytic philosophy has managed to ignore or repress Wittgenstein's teaching. Now, when contemporary analytic philosophers, in attempting to defend the method of cases, claim, as Williamson, for example, does, that linguistic expressions, and now I quote, refer to items in the mostly non-linguistic world, that the reference of a complex expression is a function of the reference of its constituents, and that the reference of a sentence determines its truth value, or when they claim, as Herman Capellan does, that the word think in I Think Louise Is Out of Town denotes the psychological state people are in when they think, and that the semantic content of the utterance is the proposition, the utterance I Think Louise Is Out of Town has a semantic content, the semantic content is that the proposition that the speaker stands in the thinking relation to the proposition that Louise is out of town. And when, on the basis of such pronouncements, they assume that the theorist's question as raised in the theorist's context is in order, in the sense that it makes clear sense and may be answered correctly or incorrectly, and that, as competent speakers, we ought to understand the question and be able to answer it correctly, just on the basis of our familiarity with the words and with the theorist's description of the case. How is one to respond to this? One thing one could do is engage in some form or another of Wittgensteinian therapy. For example, by way of the deliberate assembly, engage in some Wittgensteinian therapy by way of the deliberate assembling of reminders. One could, for example, try to show that the theorist's question has no clear or determinate sense by inviting the theorist to see or acknowledge that in different contexts, that the words intended to express his question would be expressive of very different questions or even kinds of questions. The intended lesson of such reminders would be that the theorist cannot rely on his words alone to ensure the sense of his question. The words can be used or meant in different ways and in different contexts may appropriately be understood in different ways. It is open for the theorist to then try to clarify how he uses or means his words, but it will often turn out that he is hovering indeterminately between different possible ways in which his words could be meant, that no apparently available way of meaning his words should satisfy him, given his theoretical purposes, or that he can't, given some of his theoretical commitments, mean his words as he apparently wants and needs to mean them. This form of argument is found, for example, in Austin's attack on the notion of sense data. It is arguably found in Wittgenstein's work as well, for example, in his response to Moore's attempt to list the things he knows with certainty. And it is Charles Travis's favorite form of argument. I myself find this form of argument very compelling and have used it myself as well. Another thing one could do in response to the Augustinian picture that underlies so much of contemporary practice is to respond therapeutically to moments in which the theorist attempts to articulate or defend the conception of language that underwrites the philosophical method of cases. For example, a common way of trying to defend the prevailing, broadly Augustinian conception of language has been to argue that if speakers, or the same speaker in different utterances, did not mean the same thing by some word, X, then both true communication and logical relations between utterances would be impossible or illusory. This general form of argument was originally offered by Geach and Searle. More recently, versions of it have been offered by Capellan and Lepore, by Soames, and by Williamson. In response to this general form of argument, one could offer the following series of reminders. Reminder one, what someone means by word X, or how she means it, is not the meaning of X, or even the meaning of her X. The meaning of a word may aptly and usefully be thought of as its potentiality for being meant in one way or another under suitable conditions. Our ordinary criterion for knowing the meaning of a word is using or meaning it felicitously in a wide enough range of ways under suitable conditions and responding competently to other people's use of it. One thing I try to show in When Words Are Called For is that Geach's and Searle's examples of human speech cannot truly be understood apart from seeing how the words are meant, which means that their examples, Geach's and Searle's examples, fail to show that utterances have content or clear enough sense that is separable from the human intention they may most reasonably be taken to articulate or express. Reminder two, what so-and-so means by some word X or how so-and-so means some word X is normally used in reference to some particular utterance or set of utterances made by so-and-so in some particular context, not in reference to all of so-and-so's uses of X. There is normally no correct answer to the question of what so-and-so means by some word X in general, let alone what all English speakers always mean by X. Reminder three. We normally ask, what does so-and-so mean by the word X, when there is some particular lack of clarity, some difficulty in understanding so-and-so's use of X on some particular occasion or set of occasions. Apart from some such lack of clarity, it would normally make no sense to ask what so-and-so means by X. Apart from some actual or envisioned lack of clarity, a correct or appropriate response to what does so-and-so mean by X would be, what do you mean? This is more or less what Wittgenstein says in Settle 4, that it is one of the most confusing questions. Of course, on the prevailing conception of language, the question, what does so-and-so mean by X, always makes sense, and may typically be answered by saying, by X, so-and-so means X. But that only gives us an illusion of sense. Italicizing or stressing a word does not ensure that there is anything clear one means by it. Reminder four. In order to say what so-and-so has meant by X on some occasion, or how she has meant her X, we normally give a paraphrase. A good paraphrase conveys to its audience how so-and-so's X is to be understood here, in this context. It most certainly does not give the audience something to which so-and-so's X refers, let alone something to which X always refers. Reminder 5. It is true that we can say in English, but not, for example, in Hebrew, of two or more people that they do or do not mean the same thing by a word. Again, normally in reference to the way they have actually used the word on some occasion, or set of occasions. But that does not mean that there is literally, metaphysically, some one thing or set of things that they have somehow meant with their word. Last reminder, 6. It is also true that we can say in English, but not, for example, in Hebrew, of two words, typically words that belong to two different languages, that they mean the same thing, but this is normally best understood as meaning that the two words have more or less the same function and powers in their respective languages. It does not mean, and it certainly need not mean, that there is some one thing that they both somehow always mean or refer to. If it meant that, translation would be much easier than it actually is. Reminders of this second sort are typically dismissed impatiently by mainstream analytic philosophers on the grounds that they cannot by themselves settle any weighty theoretical issue. It is important to realize, however, that they are not meant to settle any weighty theoretical issue. On something like the contrary, they are meant to ensure that no weighty theoretical issue is settled on the basis of nothing more than contingent facts about normal and ordinary usage. Here, usage of the English word meaning. Still, there seem to be limitations to therapeutic appeals to ordinary language of either the first kind that I mentioned or the second type. I'm not saying that there are only these two types. For one thing, these kinds of therapeutic appeals to ordinary language rarely move anyone already committed to the prevailing conception of language. That person thinks he has good theoretical reasons for believing in the prevailing conception of language, and he also thinks that he can easily enough accommodate the data from ordinary language, for example, by insisting on a distinction between semantics and pragmatics, or by insisting that most philosophical questions, including questions about language, concern not particular words and their meanings, but the non-linguistic world, as we saw Williamson say. And that facts about ordinary and normal usage have no bearing on those metaphysical questions. The basic problem seems to be that proponents of the prevailing conception of language cannot imagine or bring themselves to seriously consider an alternative conception. In order to be moved, they would need to be offered a viable alternative conception, it would seem. And it seems clear that therapeutic appeals to ordinary language do not by themselves offer such an alternative conception. Now, it might be thought, I myself have often thought, that it would be best if we could free ourselves altogether of any and every comprehensive conception, let alone theory, of language. And that this is precisely what the investigations was carefully designed to help us accomplish. But it is none too easy a thing to accomplish. And besides, at least for some purposes, doing altogether without a conception of language seems undesirable or unfeasible. And this brings me to the second apparent limitation of the purely therapeutic response to the Augustinian conception of language. Even someone who is not, or is no longer, committed to that conception, and is well aware of its shortcomings, may find that there are truths about our life with words that that conception may have obscured from view, but that therapeutic appeals to ordinary language do not, by themselves, suffice for bringing out. Moreover, bringing those truths into clearer view may have real practical value. For example, for those attempting to treat forms of aphasia or autism. The attempt to articulate a later Wittgensteinian conception of language, along the lines of Stanley Cavell's excursus into Wittgenstein's vision of language and of Charles Travis's The Uses of Sense, reveals deep and remarkable affinities between Wittgenstein and Merleau-Ponty on the subject of language. Deeper affinities still emerge when one goes further than either Travis or even Cavell have done in recognizing the anti-representationalist strengths in Wittgenstein's thought, such as the analogy between words and tools, or Werkzeuge, that is meant to help us overcome a flattened view of language and to recognize differences among the ways different words function in discourse, or even among the ways one and the same word may function in different contexts, or the suggestion that certain seemingly descriptive utterances are better seen not as descriptions, but as signals, or the idea that in order to disentangle conceptual entanglements concerning mental states and processes, we need to, quote, make a radical break with the idea that language always functions in the same way, always serves the same purpose, to convey thought. In the time remaining to me today, I'm not going to try to spell out a Wittgensteinian Merleau-Pontian conception of language. This is something I'm going to try to do at the Ober conference. Instead, I'm going to present a Wittgensteinian Merleau-Pontian model of how children come to master the word know and knowledge. I was prompted to try to articulate such a model by a passage in an article by Frank Jackson. In the article, Jackson usefully identifies clearly and explicitly the prevailing conception of language that underwrites the philosophical method of cases. Jackson refers to that conception as the representational view of language. According to that view, which Jackson asserts without argument, how a sentence represents things to be is a function of the representational contents of its parts and how they are combined. Jackson spells out the notion of representational content in terms of the categorization of items. A person's concepts, he writes, are the categorizations they have mastered. When they use a word for a concept, the categorization they effect with the word will be to place the item in the relevant category. Since Jackson's pronouncements are meant to support the philosophical method of cases, it is clear that the items in question are supposed to be not only items such as animals, plants, and pieces of furniture, but also the sorts of items to which philosophically troublesome words such as know, cause, free, morally responsible, mean, and so on presumably refer. For otherwise, the talk of words as instruments of categorization would not have lent any support to the philosophical method of cases. Thus, one crucial assumption that Jackson makes, and makes explicit, is that there is no philosophically significant difference between words such as tree or table and philosophically troublesome words such as know. To underscore this set of claims, Jackson turns to offer the following little story about how children acquire the word knowledge. So now we're at number one on the handout. And don't worry, I mean, you probably think, wow, all that was just the introduction. And no, this was part of the paper. So number one, children learn most of their words through interaction with, on the one hand, objects, events, and properties, these are the items, and with their parents, teachers, and other children, on the other. Everything in this area is highly contentious, but one thing is clear. At some crucial stage in the process, we latch onto the relevant pattern, we recognize the pattern and use the word for it. How did we acquire the word knowledge? We came across lots of examples, we were told a bit about what mattered, perhaps we were simply instructed that if it is false, it cannot be knowledge. At some point, we latched onto the pattern. In this way, for each competent speaker, words such as knowledge come to refer to items, and thereby become instruments of categorization, according to Jackson. This is what is then supposed to enable competent speakers to answer the theorist's questions, and answer them mostly correctly. Those questions presumably ask them to identify, in a theoretically controlled setting, worldly patterns that they must, presumably, have learned to identify in learning to employ competently the relevant words. I want to ask, how does Jackson know that this is how children come to master the word knowledge? And I suppose also other words, such as understanding, meaning, freedom, seeing, and so on. Is he basing himself on empirical observations? Has he followed children in their early years and found that this, in fact, is how children come to master a word such as knowledge? Has he consulted the work of others who have done so? The answer to these questions, I think it is clear, is that Jackson relies on no empirical observations or studies. Rather, he thinks this is what in fact happens because he thinks this is what must happen. He cannot see any other way in which a child could come to master a word such as knowledge. How else could we have acquired the word knowledge? What other than a link between the word and some worldly pattern to which it refers could guide us in using it? To begin to break through the rhetorical air of these questions, note first that the word whose acquisition ought to interest us here, where here means the context of Jackson's attempt to defend the method of cases by way of the claim of continuity, the word that ought to interest us is know, not knowledge. As far as ordinary non-philosophical discourse is concerned, the verb is far more prevalent, and it most certainly comes first in the order of acquisition. Replace the theorist, does the protagonist know that such and such, with, say, does the protagonist true belief that such and such rise to the level of knowledge? This formulation is from Ken Park. Or, is the evidence that has led the protagonist to form the true belief that such and such good enough for knowledge that such and such? This formulation is from Fantel and McGrath. And all plausibility would leak out of the claim of continuity. Even the seemingly more innocent, does the protagonist possess the knowledge that such and such, would be unnatural and biased in favor of the prevailing conception of language. Jackson presupposes that conception. So his choice to discuss the singular substantive knowledge rather than the verb know is motivated. Given the general story he wants to tell about language, he needs an item or set of items that competent speakers may come to recognize, and he needs a word that names or refers to it. Our use of the verb know depends upon an ability to detect instances of knowledge, the type of item to which know presumably refers. Remember that passage from Capellan where he says that I think Louise is out of town, denotes the thinking relation. So in order to be able to understand an utterance such as I think Louise is out of town, you need to know what it denotes, you need to know what the thinking relation is. But that assumption I now intend to try to show is unwarranted and not at all compulsory. My aim in what follows is not to tell an alternative story that is accurate in every detail about how English-speaking children actually come to be competent employers of know and its cognates. There is no reason to assume that there is a detailed story to tell that is true of all English-speaking children. What I present is better seen as a model of how English-speaking children come to master these words. The model is inspired by Wittgenstein and Merleau-Ponty, and it is fundamentally different from the one Jackson assumes. Moreover, the alternative model receives support from empirical findings, the kind of support that cannot, I think, be claimed for Jackson's Augustinian model. This, what I just said, and I suspect is problematic. I mean, what it is exactly to claim that a certain conception of language receives support from empirical findings? I'm not sure. I'm sure I will get into trouble because of that. But Let's see how. According to the alternative model, which is summarized on the handout in number 2, it is not instances of knowledge that the child must learn to discern in order to become a competent employer of know, and its cognates, but rather different types of humanly significant situations in which constructions featuring know may be called for and do significant work of one type or another. The pattern the child needs to learn to pick out and follow is not some general pattern in which knowledge presumably consists and to which knowledge presumably refers. That pattern, I'm proposing, need not exist, but rather a pattern, and in fact several different and variously related patterns, of usage of constructions featuring know, or one of its cognates. As Michael Tomasello has summarized recent empirical findings about how children learn their native language, and that's 3 on the handout, word learning does not consist in the child engaging in a reflective cognitive task in an attempt to make correct mappings of word to world, but rather it emerges naturally from situations in which children are engaged in social interactions, in which they are attempting to understand and interpret adult communicative intentions as expressed in utterances. Normally, the child first hears and begins to use know, and most of her other early acquired words, in the context of shared, significant, and increasingly familiar activities into which utterances are woven. Changing a diaper, preparing and eating a meal, going to the store for a walk, taking a bath, playing, and so on. These shared activities often take the form of what Jerome Bruner calls formats, that is, routinized and repeated interactions in which an adult and a child do things to and with each other, and which enable the adult and child to cooperate in the passing on of language. End of quote from Bruner. The primary use of words in these early activities, as Catherine Nelson observes, and that's 4 on the handout, is pragmatic, she says, not symbolic. Language uses in these shared activities help to mark, to move them forward, but language is not initially used to represent them as such in the child's cognitive or communicative productions. Not the clearest passage, but I think what she's trying to say is clear enough. Thus, for example, relatively early on, English-speaking children normally come to use the construction, I don't know. Or, more realistically, I don't know. They acquire this expression not as a combination of separate words that, by virtue of their meanings and the way they are put together, attribute to their utterer the property of not knowing this or that. Rather, they acquire it as what Tomasello has called an utterance level construction. For the child learning to speak, as for most speakers of English, I think, I don't know is, as he puts it in number 5, a fixed expression with a single coherent meaning equivalent to a shrug of the shoulders. The complexity, including combinatorial complexity, of non-linguistic, merely bodily gestures, such as a shrug of the shoulders, often goes unnoticed and mostly goes underappreciated. This makes it hard to see the natural continuity that I think both Wittgenstein and Merleau-Ponty see between such gestures and linguistic utterances, and to think of the latter on the model of the former, that is, to think of utterances or linguistic gestures as natural extensions of non-linguistic gestures. It is therefore worth reminding ourselves that non-linguistic bodily gestures have both syntax and what Wittgenstein calls grammar. Just like an utterance of, I don't know, a shrug of the shoulders is sometimes called for by the situation. When not discoverable as called for in any way or as appropriate to the situation, a shrug, if it could even be called that, would be incomprehensible. The shrugger would and could mean nothing by it. When in place, a shrug may have any of indefinitely many possible meanings and carry various kinds of degrees of commitment for the shrugger, depending on both the situation and its gestural expressive accompaniments. And the shrug can be justified or unjustified, perfectly acceptable or somehow problematic, or otherwise challengeable. Correlatively, responses to a shrug also need to be called for and appropriate. For example, a shrug may only competently be challenged or rebuked in certain ways, but not others, depending on its context. Competent shruggers will know these sorts of things, and competent employers of I don't know will know them as well. They will know them not in the sense of articulating them to themselves explicitly, or even being able to articulate them, let alone fully, whatever that means, but rather in the sense of exhibiting sensitivity and adhering to them in their bodily or linguistic shrugs, and in their responses to other people's use of these gestures. If knowing these things, in this sense of knowing, means possessing or partially possessing the concept of knowledge and knowing what knowledge is, then competent shruggers possess or partially possess the concept of knowledge and know what knowledge is. And yet, surely, one could be a competent employer of shrugs, whether verbal or non-verbal, without being able to detect some worldly pattern that is identifiable in the world apart from any context of significant shrugging and to which shrugs refer. But we're only at the beginning. The child who has started to use, I don't know, more or less as we do, is still far from being a master of the word know and full possessor of our concept of knowledge. She still has quite a ways to go. So let us continue to follow her. In addition to I don't know, she will also hear early on and ultimately come to use the exclaimed, I know, that has the force of a signal, meaning something like, I have an idea, I can answer this question, I can go on, I can do it myself. And the I know of sympathy, I know you're tired. And the I know of sharing an effective response, Mommy, Daddy is being silly, I know. Later on, I suppose, she will learn the I know that is used to express confidence and has the force, as Wittgenstein points out in Uncertainty, and of something like, I'm sure. I know you forget. I just know it's a forgery. This last one was an allusion to a famous example of Gitch's that I have argued cannot naturally be heard as Gitch needs it to be heard. And there is the I know that has the force of roughly, I already have the information, you don't need to tell me. Probably later she will hear and ultimately come to be able to use I know in the sense Austin focuses on, in which it has roughly the force of take my word for it, or you can safely take my word for it. She will also hear and ultimately come to use competently the question, how do you know? Which is normally used for inviting the other to tell us her basis for asserting something. And she will learn what sorts of responses to this question are acceptable and which ones are unhelpful, silly, outrageous, unreasonable, or otherwise incompetent. And so on and so forth. I lay absolutely no claim to have given an exhaustive list, even just of general types of usages of only the I know construction. Precisely not. The list is potentially inexhaustible. To be a competent employer of know is to be able to keep up with this inexhaustibility. Being able to use competently the above and indefinitely many other more or less closely related constructions featuring know, and to respond competently to other people's use of them in a wide enough range of contexts, is our ordinary normal criterion for knowing the meaning of know, and hence for possessing the concept of knowledge and knowing what knowledge is. So by this criterion, our exemplary child will ultimately come to possess the concept of knowledge and to know what knowledge is, as well as anyone does, I would say. But this, on my model, without ever coming to be able to discern some single pattern in which knowledge consists and which is detectable in the world apart from any context of significant employment of know or one of its cognates. I do not mean to deny that the uses of know and its cognates mentioned above, and other possible uses of these words, are more or less closely and more or less straightforwardly related to each other. What the child acquires is a historical product that is the result of natural evolution. And this means that the various uses and senses of know should be expected to have precisely a natural unity. What I question is the assumption that underlying this unity and ensuring it is a worldly pattern in which knowledge consists and to which know and its cognates refer, a pattern whose instances may be detected even apart from any context of significant use of these words. This idea of natural unity harks back to Wittgenstein's notion of family resemblance, except that Wittgenstein applies the notion to different objects, to the different objects named by the same word, whereas I'm here expanding the notion to refer to different types of use of the same word. And it matters, in either case, that the identification of family resemblance is quite typically ad hoc. It is quite easy to think of examples of languages that have evolved differently from English in such a way that some of the work normally done by means of the English word know is done in those other languages by means of words that would not normally be used to translate know. To be sure, in order to become a competent employer of know and its cognates, the child will need to use and understand these words as parts of combinations of words she has never encountered before, and in new context. As Stanley Cavell has argued, anyone lacking in the ability for more or less creative projections of words into new context will not become a competent speaker of a natural language. Merleau-Ponty says that this ability to transcend and thereby transform what is given to us, or give it new significance, defines us, not just as speakers, but in every aspect of our experience. Essentially, the same ability for creative projections, including combinatorial creativity, is manifested by the child who, having experienced its mother hiding her face with her hands and then revealing it as she exclaims, peekaboo, comes one day to hide his face with his hands and to reveal it as he exclaims, peekaboo. Not merely an imitation of his mother, but assuming the role of the agent initiating the game. And later on, comes to hide his whole body, maybe, or a doll behind the sofa, and then reveal it as he exclaims, peekaboo. This example is from Brunner, and what I mean it to illustrate is combinatorial creativity without representation or reference. Similarly, having only heard and responded to others saying, I don't know, our child will at some point come to say, I don't know, in an appropriate context, and to competently follow upon other people's responses to her, I don't know. Having, at any given point, only heard the expression used in response to finitely many questions, she will need to understand it when it is used and to use it herself in response to some other question. Having only heard the I know of sympathy used in the context of, say, someone's being in pain, she will understand and respond appropriately to, I know, you're tired, without ever having used or even heard that particular combination of words before. Having only heard and participated in finitely many exchanges in which the how do you know construction is used and responded to, she will come to be able to respond competently, reasonably, acceptably, helpfully, to the question, and to be able to assess and challenge competently other people's responses to that question in indefinitely many new contexts, and so on and so forth. At no point in the process, however, will the child need to be able to detect some worldly pattern, identifiable apart from any context of significant employment of know or one of its cognates, in which knowledge consists and to which knowledge refers. The word know refers. As Tomasello puts it, summarizing the results of numerous studies of first language acquisition, that's number 6 on the handout. Children do not have to create each of their utterances from the ground up using meaningful words, but rather they integrate together in various ways many different kinds of already constructed constructions, each with an associated communicative function. The child does not begin with words and morphemes and glue them together. Rather, she starts with already constructed pieces of language of various shapes, sizes, and degrees of obstruction, and whose internal complexity she may control to varying degrees, and then cuts and pastes these together in a way appropriate to the current communicative situation. The combinatorial complexity and indefinite expandability of language has often been cited as a decisive consideration in favor of the prevailing conception of language. Following Wittgenstein, Merleau-Ponty, and Tomasello, I'm suggesting that it is not. The undeniable fact that we can use and understand combinations of words we have never encountered before does not mean that the words must come with the sort of meanings envisioned by the Augustinian. Instead, they can come with a history of use, of which we are both the inheritors and the carriers. As Merleau-Ponty puts it, it is for having been employed in different contexts that the word gradually takes on a sense that it is impossible to fix absolutely. It's open-ended. In order to become a competent employer of noun and its cognates, the child will need to get the hang of the use of different types of constructions featuring these words. She will need to come to know or to anticipate successfully their occasions and their different sorts of significance, what sorts of positions in the interpersonal world one assumes in using certain expressions in certain ways, in certain situations, what the conditions are for using these words in one way or another, and what commitments, liabilities, risks one takes upon oneself in using the words in one way or another, and in responding in one way or another to other people's use of them. At no point in the process, however, will the child need to map these words onto the world. Certainly not if the mapping is supposed to hold independently of any context of significant use of the words and to connect individual words to individual worldly items. Though becoming fully competent with knowing its cognates requires varying degrees and kinds of what may be called an abstraction, I was uncomfortable with this notion of abstraction, but Jim gave me a way of understanding or thinking about abstraction that helps. If you contrast it with extraction, then I think abstraction is fine and not misleading. So I'm saying, and though becoming fully competent with knowing its cognates requires varying degrees and kinds of what may be called abstraction, at no point in the process of acquisition does the speaker need to arrive at some final level of abstraction that supposedly underlies, guides, and unifies all uses of these words. Not until she starts philosophizing within the framework of the prevailing conception of language, at any rate. And when she comes to do that, if she does, she may in fact be chasing not worldly items to which our words have come to refer, but at best, shadows cast by the ways we talk. And at worst, philosophically constructed chimeras that are more or less remotely related to those shadows.